So glad you could join us for another episode of Cranford Radio. My name is Bernie Wagenblast. Our guest today is Amanda Kukas. She is the founder and owner of Functional Speech and Language. She is a Cranford resident. Amanda, welcome to Cranford Radio.
Thank you for having me.
As always, when I do a podcast, I want to start with the basics. And the basics here, tell me what functional speech and language is, the kind of work that you do, the services that you offer, please.
Functional speech and language is a place where we can go into the child's home and see how they interact in their natural environment and then figure out how we can help a child reach their goals in their natural environment. Because it's great if they could do stuff in therapy with me or within a clinical wall, but they really need to be able to communicate with their loved ones, their caregivers, their teachers, out in the community, at home. So that's really where we focus, try to get the child to communicate in their daily life, not just in therapy.
You say child. So what age group are you primarily aiming toward?
Technically I could treat between birth and 21, but I personally see kids that are 15 months to 10 years old in that age range.
When you're talking about the youngest ones, somebody who's 15 months old, what are some of the issues? Are they, I guess most 15 month olds are not really communicating in terms of sentences or maybe even words necessarily. So what are some of the issues that you're seeing with the very youngest clients that you're treating?
So when they are 15 months old, like the little ones, we're either seeing them for communication or sometimes feeding. I've recently started taking more feeding courses. So now I'm a pediatric feeding therapist too. So some of the little ones we'll do feeding therapy with. If it is communication based, a lot of those kids are either not babbling yet, or they started to babble but then stopped, or they only have a few words in their vocabulary, or they only have a few sounds in their vocabulary. Some kids, their play skills are not advancing. So they're still at the phase where they just push a button to activate a toy and it lights up. And that's kind of what they do. They're not playing back and forth with a person yet. They're just kind of still playing isolated on their own with those cause and effect type toys. So that's the little ones. Those are mostly the kids that we see. And then we try to take them from where they're at in terms of their skills and their communication and then bring them up to where they should be.
You mentioned feeding therapy. Tell me what that is. I'm not familiar with that.
So it is a newer venture for me. But feeding therapy is the kids that I would see are the kids that are trying to transition from bottle and breast to solid. So kids that maybe aren't advancing their textures, don't eat a variety of foods. Some kids that might have some structural deficits, meaning like a tongue tie type thing, like they've either need a tongue tie release or they've gotten a release and then they come to me and we work after to try to regain that function now that they have mobility of their tongue again. Kids that are maybe not the most adventurous eaters, where they kind of stick with what they know and what they like, and they really don't like to try things that are new. Those are the types of kids that I see when it comes to like feeding therapy. I don't do the babies with like the bottle feeding. That's a whole nother area.
You mentioned about children who are tongue-tied. Is there generally a relationship between communication deficits and feeding issues?
There could be. It's not if one then the other, but there definitely is a trickle down effect. So if you do have a child that is having difficulty with feeding, sometimes those are kids that then I see in preschool. And when I see them at preschool or kindergarten, and they're having trouble with their speech sounds, a lot of times I find that it's the speech sounds are either distorted or they're having trouble with it because they're not able to move like their lips, their tongue, their jaw the way that they should be. And sometimes that is because their feeding skills were not developed or matured to the point where they can best support the speech production. So it's not if then that. It's a mm-hmm. huge gray area. Mm-hmm. But there is a correlation between the two. So that's why with those kids that are a little bit older, maybe like 4, 5, 6, I will work on some oral motor exercises along with the speech Some kids, we also include food in that because sometimes, if especially if the kids are younger, like if they're 3 or 4, if I'm like, put your tongue at the top of your mouth behind your teeth, they can't follow those types of directions yet. They shouldn't be able to do that. So then sometimes I'll put food up there and we'll use food and be like, okay, just lick the food on your top of your tongue, or here's a lollipop or a piece of food they like. Instead of saying stick your tongue out, I'll just be like, lick this, so then their brain, they can lick. But if I'm like, stick your tongue straight out, that's hard for them to do. So sometimes we'll use food, not so much feeding therapy, but we'll use food in therapy to help treat those kids with speech sound disorders too.
Tell me a little bit about your training and how you got into this line of work.
I went to grad school at Kane University. When I was an undergrad, I did not know what I wanted to do. And one of my friends were like, oh, well, you love kids. You love kids, but you don't want to be a teacher. Have you thought about speech? So I started to volunteer at a hypnotherapy clinic, and I got really close with the music therapist there, and there was an OT, and the owner was a speech therapist, and I just loved it, absolutely loved it. So then I went on for my graduate degree at Kane University. I worked at a special needs school after graduating for 2 years. I worked at an outpatient center with kids for the next 8 years, before then starting my own business. And now I see kids in their homes and always doing continuing education, listening to podcasts or reading articles online. Like I like to learn. Learning is what gives me the confidence then to provide the best therapy for my clients. So I'm always learning. I'm always learning, always looking for another technique or another way to support a child, because there's no recipe. There's no, okay, you have a kid that can't say their S's, you got to do A, B, C to get there. Like, if it was that straightforward, I would not have a job. So continuing education and continuing to grow my knowledge base is an ongoing part of my week.
In terms of the children that come to see you, is it typically because their pediatrician has recommended to the parents that they bring their child to a speech therapist, or maybe the teacher in preschool or elementary school has made that recommendation, or do parents seek you out independently? Or is it a combination of all three?
Short answer, it's a combo. Longer answer, a lot of the parents do refer themselves or are referred to me through like their friend. I do network with pediatricians. It is on my to-do list to reach out to even more pediatricians, because I do think that I get a certain referral from pediatricians, but then there's other things that I know I can help with, and I don't always get those referrals from pediatricians. One of my goals over the next month is to talk to them more and let them know that I'm here, let them know the things, other things that I can help with, like the feeding, because not everybody knows that, a speech therapist is able to help with feeding skills. And also the teachers. There are a few daycares and private daycare centers and preschool teachers that do provide the family with my information. Some do, some don't. I've recently learned there's, like, depending on the school, some schools will give like a questionnaire to parents, and they'll do their own screening and then provide recommendations from that screening. And then other schools don't do that, but they might have conferences. I've been reaching out to schools recently to try to provide screening services so that these kids are getting the therapy sooner rather than later. Because there are a lot of things that we can accomplish in those preschool years that will then set those kids up for success when they go to elementary school. So, like, my goal is to get those kids when they're young, when they're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, before they get to kindergarten and first grade, so that they're ready and they have all the prerequisite skills. They are able to learn from their environment and communicate and speak as clear as to be expected for different ages. So I do provide some screening services for daycares in the area to see if we can identify some of these kids that might need some help.
I would imagine, Amanda, that in many cases, not all, but in many cases, there is a relationship between speech issues and hearing issues. Do you work with audiologists in terms of trying to identify where there may be some problems because maybe the child is not hearing words and sounds clearly and therefore has a tougher time trying to replicate them, or is that a totally separate issue?
So I always refer that the family goes to get an audiology evaluation, specifically by a pediatric audiologist and not just a screener at the pediatrician's, because they look for different things. Like the screening at the pediatrician is looking for one thing, but then when you go to the pediatric audiologist, they are listening to all the different tones and frequencies that a child needs to be able to hear in order to speak clearly. I don't necessarily work hand in hand with audiologists, but it is normally a recommendation because if there is any impact to hearing, it very well can affect how the therapy goes and how that child progresses. There is a side of the field where therapists will work with kids that are deaf or do have cochlear implants or do have hearing loss. I don't particularly work with those. Like if I had a child in that situation, then that's probably when I would refer out to an SLP that has that specialty.
Talk a little bit about how you see the children. Is it in person? Is it via video? How do you interact with the children and their parents?
It's currently in person. During COVID, we did do some teletherapy, but everything right now is in person. So I either one-on-one with the child at their daycare. And then I always try to then communicate with the teacher either before and after the direct treatment with the child. And then if we're in the family's homes, I always encourage the family to be in the therapy session with me because I need them to see what I'm doing, why I'm doing it. And then we kind of formulate a plan to see how can they replicate it during their daily life. Because I don't like to give like homework per se. It's more of practice and figuring out, okay, if the goal is that the child is going to increase the amount of verbs that they're using, how can we do that? You know, they're with their kid when they change their diaper. For the little ones, they're with their kids when they change their diaper, when they mealtimes, bedtime, getting dressed, like all those things that they're already doing with their kids is opportunities to work on that communication and that goal. So then we'll try to figure out, okay, what might be the best routine and opportunity to do what I'm doing in therapy, but then doing that every day. So I do like the parents to be involved so that we can kind of walk through that and they can see it and hear it and even practice it right in front of me.
How much time do you typically spend with a child, say, each week?
Most sessions are 45 minutes once a week. Occasionally, I'll have a kid that's twice a week. The kids that I'm treating for either apraxia or some speech sound disorders, I might see for 30 minutes once or twice a week. And some of the little ones will do an hour because we do a lot of family coaching with the little ones. So when I say little, I mean like those 15 to like 2.5, 3-year-old, 15 months to like 3-year-olds that are either like late talkers or working on receptive expressive language, working on play skills. Those are the kids that I really need the full hour for because those are the kids that need time to learn who I am and trust me and figure out that, like, I'm not this weird person coming into their house, that we're actually going to have some fun. And, you know, once they trust me and we're having fun, then I can get to the work part. And then I can get to the part where I have to teach the parent, and then the parent can try. And then, so like, we need that hour. That hour goes by very quick to accomplish all the things we need to do.
We talked a little bit about the parents' role, but do you meet one-on-one with the parents without the child there to maybe get a little more technical than a child would be appropriate for?
I did do that more during COVID. It's something that I can do because I am a Hannon trained therapist. So I do have training in parent coaching, and it's a program used specifically to coach parents. So you wouldn't have therapy with the child, you would just be doing coaching with the families. It just, I haven't had an opportunity really to do that. Most of the families want the direct treatment and the coaching. So that's why the hour sessions are popular because then they kind of get it all in one. But it's definitely doable. It's definitely something that I offer. It's just not something that is always able to be completed, whether it's like scheduling or whatever the case may be.
You talked that some of the therapy you do in preschools and such, obviously the parents have the most important role, but I would imagine the teachers also have a role. I know there is such a thing as an IEP when you get into regular school, I guess starting with kindergarten. I don't know if such a thing exists for preschools, but how do you work with the teachers? If you're not necessarily in the school doing the therapy, how would you interact, or how would the parents interact with the teachers to let them know about some of the things that are important for that particular child?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different things that I've done. One school, we have meetings. So maybe like once or twice a year, school year, we'll meet as a group, like all the members on the team, me, the teacher, the administrator, the parent. If there's an OT or PT or an ABA specialist, like we'll meet together for like a half an hour just to kind of touch base. But most of the time, I just get permission from the parents to be able to talk to the other members of the team so that I can talk to the teacher, I can talk to the OT, I can talk to the ABA therapist, the PT, whoever that child's seeing, the music therapist. I really do try to carve out time to reach out to everybody and make sure that we are all on the same page. And if one person's doing one thing in OT, then I might try to incorporate more sensory-based activities to help support the skills that they're learning in OT. So as long as the parent gives me permission to talk to other members of the team, I can then do that. When I'm in the school, then I'm talking to the teachers directly. There's some kids that I see in the schools that I'm there for speech sounds. So that's more one-on-one. I check in with the teacher in the beginning. I tell the teacher what we had worked on at the end. And I might say, like, their target sound is SH, you know, and you're sometimes it actually lines up wonderfully that, especially with the kindergartners, actually, because they learn all these sounds. So there's times where I'm working on SH and I'm like, oh, it's our quiet sound. And then the child's like, oh, that's our sound of the week. And they're like all excited because so sometimes it actually lines up great. So then I'll talk to the teacher and be like, okay, well, what kind of activities are you doing for the sound of the week? And like, we'll talk about it. So it's full circle. Other times I'm in the classrooms with the teachers and I'm there to support social skills. It's more of a push-in model. So I will wrap my therapy around the activities that the class is doing, whether it's out on the playground, whether it's centers, whether it's circle time, free play. I'm with that child trying to facilitate their interactions with their peers. And then I normally explain to the teacher what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, and let them know that if they have the time, if they're able to get a little bit more one-on-one time with that child, that they can then also be doing the same things and support the skills in the same way.
To wrap up, Amanda, in terms of covering your fees, obviously people can pay you directly, but I'm curious, does insurance, health insurance, ever cover the types of services you offer? And is there state aid, you know, once a child gets to be school age, or maybe even before school age, that helps pay for these kinds of services that a child may need?
Because it's a medical expense, families can use their out-of-network benefits. So I do have a number of families that take the documentation that I give them and then they submit a claim to their insurance company, and the insurance company will reimburse the parent directly based on their plan. So some parents get 90% back, some kids get 40, 60, it really depends on their plan, but that is definitely an option for a lot of families. They can also use flexible spending or health equity cards as well if their employer participates in those programs. State aid, I don't know. I haven't had that come up, but definitely with the health insurance, I've had a number of families get reimbursed from their insurance companies.
Well, we've been talking on this episode of Cranford Radio with Amanda Kukis. She is the founder and owner of Functional Speech and Language. Amanda, thanks so much for being my guest here on Cranford Radio.
Thank you for having me. I had fun.